Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Welcome to Season 6, Episode 1. I am recording this just shy of our 5th birthday. Watch with Jen began on March 3rd of 2020. I can't believe we've gotten here. I want to thank you so much for listening, especially all of the guests for appearing and talking about movies with me. Your support has really meant the world, and I'm so incredibly fortunate to have you aboard, and I hope that I continue to delight you and improve as the show continues. The first episode is a little different than what you're used to. This year has been just kind of like a horror movie, essentially, for most people around the world, especially here in America with everything going on. And it was devastating to see the effects of the fires on Los Angeles, which is a city that I love. Most of my friends are there. It's my favorite place to visit. I went like a half a dozen times in the last couple of years. And I was probably driving people crazy by checking in way too much as the fires were blazing. But I was extraordinarily worried, and I wanted to think of something that I could do to lend support to my friends out there and pay tribute to the city that welcomed me so beautifully over the last couple of years. I don't have the money, obviously, to donate to all of the worthy causes. I'm not there to like get involved and start volunteering on the ground. I would love to. I can't wait to go back. I hope I can soon. But I figured that the next best thing I could do was ask my friends, anybody who wanted to take part, to join me for short little discussions, anywhere from like 10 to 30 minutes or so, about LA movies that they love, because LA is an industry town. We're trying to bring the industry back to Los Angeles to get people working there again. So it was very cool that so many people said yes immediately and joined me to talk about some of their favorite films. There were so many conversations that this episode would be way too long if I put them all together in one, so it will be at least two parts, and you will experience that soon. The theme for the season, if you're not following our Patreon or me on social media, it's kind of, I'm calling this season of Watch with Jen our Sullivan's Travels season, which, if you know the old Preston Sturges movie about a filmmaker who wants to make really serious stuff and he goes through just horrific things, and at the end of the movie realizes that there is grace and beauty and worth in making people laugh and making them feel good. That is what I want this year. I want to bring on people and celebrate human contributions to cinema. No AI on this podcast. I want to have people talk about the movies that made them fall in love with movies and the stuff that they find entertaining. We're going to have a million different themes. We're going to explore everything like we always do. But this year, I'm really striving to bring on people to talk about movies that make them happy. I know we all could use that right now. We need the distraction. And so it's going to be a really cool season. I've recorded a few episodes, and we do have some heavier stuff coming. Don't worry, my drama lovers, you will be in good hands. There's one I'm recording next week on conspiracy theory movies that I think it will be especially good right now. But along with everybody else, I have been going through it as well. Again, if you do not follow me, this is news, but I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disorder that is not something that I was expecting this year, and my pain level has increased, and I just started treatment, and it's very risky and scary treatment. So I personally could use a little bit of a break too, and I'm hoping to give you the same thing because everyone is going through something right now. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy this season of Watch with Jen. It might be a little sporadic if I'm not doing great, a week or so, you might not get a new episode, but we are going to hit 250 episodes, in the first half of this season. So there's plenty of great shows for you to explore. So I know you'll be in good hands, but I just wanted to share that a little bit in case I'm not the most consistent, compared to previous seasons. So again, let's take it away and thank you so much for being here. Well, first up, I'm thrilled to welcome my friend Dwayne Zwierzynski, who is the Edgar-nominated author of such novels as Revolver, Canary, Severance Package, and California Bear. He's also the author of the Seamus award-winning Charlie Hardy series and has written over 250 comics for Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, Valiant, and IDW. Well, I am thrilled to have Dwayne Zwierzynski here today to talk about Jackie Brown. It's a movie we both love. And I know, Dwayne, that this week you saw it at the New Beverly. So talk to me about that.
I did, and thanks for having me back, Jen. This is fantastic.
Of
Yeah, it was
course.
sort of coincidence. You and I discussed, what LA movie we want to talk about, and eventually landed on Jackie Brown. And I happened to check the New Bev schedule. Like, oh, it's playing that week, so I feel like I had to go see it. And it was actually the first time I've seen it on the big screen. I saw it back, in the '90s when it was on DVD or whatever it was, VHS perhaps even, and then later, I've seen it. I don't know. I own a copy of it. I have all of Tarantino's work, and I revisit it. And the more I revisit it, the more I like it. And I realize it's a middle-aged person's movie. It just comes, I guess, in your
It is.
20s, it's like, who are these fogies? Who is it? It's like, you want that kind of that those fireworks of Pulp Fiction. This is not that. This is very much a hang movie, which I've grown to love as I've gotten older. So what was your reaction rewatching it? I'm not sure how often you've seen it, but.
I love this one. I actually think this might be my favorite movie of his, and it has been for quite some time. I was a weirdo. I was a big Elmore Leonard person, as a teenager, and so I had already read Rum Punch by the time I saw the movie, so that was great. And yeah, I love this movie. There's that joke that Tarantino likes to say, like everyone says their favorite is Pulp Fiction and everyone's mom's favorite is Jackie Brown. And I'm like, well, I guess I'm a mom. I guess my brother is a mom. I guess like a
We're
lot.
all moms.
Yeah, because I love this film. Yeah. And it was weird watching it because I'm 43. I'm going to turn 44 in a couple months. And in the movie,
Awesome.
Jackie is saying something about like being 44.
Oh
That's
yeah.
holy shit. It's kind of like what Jed said when he watched Night Moves and he's like, oh my God, I'm the same age as Gene Hackman.
It's so funny you say that, literally, because the moment that jumped out at me in this screening at the New Bev was at one point Max Cherry, played by Robert Forster, says, I'm 56 years old. I'm like, oh God. I mean, I'm literally turning 53 next week. I'm like, oh boy. Yeah, I feel you, Max. I feel you, man. I get it. Because this movie's about like finding yourself, halfway through life and trying to figure your stuff out, right? I mean, Jackie Brown, her whole thing is like, who am I? What am I going to do? What's my, I'm stuck in this sort of, dead end job, the worst airline, in the world. And like, and she has this chance that, to grab something for herself. And it's kind of great. And it kind of, that resonated with me. Whereas it didn't resonate with me when I was, a 26-year-old, idiot watching this thing. Like, oh, where's the time cuts? Where's the violence? It's not that kind of movie, which is wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. There's that line about I always feel like I'm starting over, and I wrote that one down.
Yes.
And when you're young and you're watching it, you just think, oh, this poor woman, and she's had a rough go. And then when you get older, you're like, we're always kind of starting over. I remember back in it was either the late 90s or the early aughts, they were predicting that by middle age, you would have had seven jobs or so you would have changed careers seven different times. And I remember like listening to that with my dad, who worked at the same place from like 18 till he retired. And my grandpa had done the same thing. And I'm like, I have family members who have completely changed careers by now. Like my brother, was in law enforcement, and now he's like a building inspector, and does he did construction. And it's like,
Wow.
you reinvent yourself and change jobs. So it was kind of interesting watching this and
That is so true.
the
That is so
directions
true.
you go in. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's really fact, because even like, in the context of, Tarantino's career, he's also changed job, kind of. I mean, he's gone through phases, There
Yeah.
were the Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction phase. This was like almost like the first movie where he was the more mature director, it feels like, and it kind of led to other things. Kill Bill was insane, but then he kind of still, his historicals, his westerns, he goes through
Yeah.
everyone's, I think it's important as, artists, we're going to call it writers, directors, whoever, it's like those phases. You have to embrace them and not fight them, and
Yeah.
not try to. My grandfather worked at the same chemical company for, 40 years, got the
Yeah.
whole thing, retirement, and it's like that was normal. That is not our generation. That's not what happens anymore. We all
No.
try to reinvent ourselves. So that hit me the same way. It was like, wow, she's so right. We do kind of constantly try. I mean, all the characters are sort of like trying to figure their shit out. Like De
Yes.
Niro playing Lewis Garrett, like he's this guy, he looks like he's shell-shocked the entire time. Like he's just out of prison.
Yeah.
He is sort of flummoxed by, his new reality, and that kind of, wow, you either run from it and end up disastrously, or you can like be like Max Cherry and Jackie Brown and try to figure things out. And
Yeah.
anyway, so that again, this viewing the new BEV is funny. It was a sold out crowd. All Tarantino's movies are usually sold out. The cool thing is this one was not usually it's Tarantino Midnights. And speaking of old age, I cannot stay up enough to see a
Oh
midnight
gosh,
movie.
no.
Unless I'm already out and I'm seeing a marathon, that's one thing. But if I actually
Okay.
am heading out to see a movie at midnight, no way. I just can't do
No.
it. So this is a rare treat to see that at like 7:30 p.m.
Yeah.
Senior citizens hour is awesome to see this with a crowd of actually, most people were a lot younger than I am. It was like young, millennials, and I say some Gen Z folks. The couple next to me, the girlfriend had not seen it before. Her boyfriend said, "Oh, it's awesome." And she was like sort of dragged along. I think she really dug it. She was surprised by how mature it was. So that was interesting to
Yeah.
hear. That's the plus of seeing it, things in the BEV, the audience reactions are always different, and even the movie I've seen, a dozen times will hit differently with the right crowd. That's kind of cool.
It is very cool. And of course, this has a just blockbuster cast. I think one of my
Yeah.
favorite scene stealers is Michael Keaton because he played the same
Yes.
part in Out of Sight. And he's a guy, because we've seen Out of Sight and we've seen this, where he's going through some stuff with his marriage and his, cheating on his wife
Yeah.
and all the switching from ATF and FBI
Yeah.
and like all the things that he's involved in. And I just love him in this movie, like from the gum chewing and the way
Everything.
the energy, like he has to go walk around during the interrogation, and it's very Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
And it's great because you see him try to like intimidate and put her off balance and her inability to get rattled, even though she starts, like we see it in her eyes a little bit. But
Right.
yeah, I just love watching these actors play off each other.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The action in this movie is not so much physical action. It's all these power struggles, these little mini power struggles.
Yeah.
I love that. Even like, Samuel L. Jackson,
Oh,
intimidating as hell as
amazing.
Ordell. Amazing. But yeah, Jackie pushes back on him and like
Oh,
outfoxes
yeah.
him all every time. It's great. I mean, I also appreciate that. Little mini power struggles, right? These little things that, you try to get across to say, hey, I'm all of that. And someone else says, no, you're not.
Yeah.
I've got this. I'll do an end run around you and, get away with it. It's great because you really don't know where Jackie's allegiances are until like the very end. And it's with her, which is wonderful. Love that. So, the main thing though that jumped out at me, and this is again in the lens of our, you mentioned this as, a series of LA movies you'll be
Yeah.
discussing with other awesome guests. So this to me is funny because it's interesting. It's set in LA, but it started out as you know, Rum Punch was a very Florida novel,
Oh yeah.
which is huge.
Yeah,
So
Florida and
that's interesting.
Detroit. That was Elmer
Yeah.
Leonard's bag. I remember Dave Barry calling Carl Hiaasen and Elmer Leonard's genre the South Florida wacko genre, and I was like,
That's awesome.
wow.
I do love that.
Yeah.
And it's funny. I mean, at first you'd think that, in fact, I think I know that I read this, Tarantino and Roger Avery were terrified to actually talk to Elmer Leonard about, hey, here's what we did to your book. Elmer Leonard loved it. He actually thought it was the best adaptation he ever read and one of the best
Yes.
screenplays he ever read, which is, and I think what he's reacting to, I'm just guessing, was that they kind of honored the spirit of the book. Like they transplanted it to LA, but not in a shallow way. It's not like the LA we all think we know, Hollywood, but it's very specific. It's Tarantino's like stomping grounds in the South Bay, which is, before when I first watched it, I had no idea about the South Bay. I didn't know LA very well. All these years later, I, you know the area a lot better now. I've lived here almost 10 years. And it's like, wow, this is a South Bay movie. This is wonderful. I just love the, the tour through that, this part of LA that people usually don't really dig into, unless you're a native.
Yeah,
So that's
all the
interesting to
little
me.
cities that they mention, basically,
Yeah,
like getting off the bus
absolutely.
and where one of his girls lives. I also love some of the little the
Right,
ways
right.
that the actors or the characters kind of like take little digs at each other.
Oh,
Like,
totally.
you need three women. Can you handle that? Like, oh yeah, I got the women covered. And then, or with Max Cherry and Samuel Jackson, like it was your idea to take the picture though of him with his black coworker. I think that's funny, but it doesn't shake. And he watches for that reaction, and it doesn't shake Max at all. Like I could give a shit what this guy thinks. And that's one of the reasons why you love Max. He is completely unflappable. Has one of the best lines as film geeks, where it's like, what are you gonna see? Something that looks good and starts soon, where he just shows up in the movie. That's kind of the dream, right?
That's so true. I just his whole vibe, I really love him more and more. And it's funny, I have to mention at at the New Bev experience, I once saw Robert Forster there for a screening. They were showing another one of his films from the early 80s called Walking the Edge, which has been re-released over the years on Blu-ray, very fancy, cool edition. But it was like so surreal sitting there. I'm like, wow, one row and like three seats up front of me was, my God, it's Max Cherry sitting there. I was just blown away. I mean, that's the one thing about the New Bev. Like, you never truly know who you'll be sitting next to or around. And that kind of, I don't know, to me adds a, it adds something for, it's a rare thing and it's kind of cool. So I thought about, Robert, we lost what, a bunch of years ago, right by now. It's been 3 or 4 years at least. So, I just thought it was really, really, again, the specialness of that place. And Max Cherry, though, the more he's like my new spirit animal, as the kids say, I mean, really, he's just doing his thing. You can't shake him.
He's the
You want to be
ultimate
him.
character.
He's open to new things. Like, Jackie mentions the Delphonics. He goes out and buys a cassette tape. I love that. It's like the characters
Like you see
engage.
him falling in love, and that's really beautiful.
In stages. And I also know, did you notice that he knows what he's getting into. He knows it's not a storybook romance. He knows he's not
He
going to
knows
like,
it isn't going to end well.
but
But
he's
he's
okay to go
just,
with it. He wants to help her and he's cool with it. And that's kind of interesting to me. So, and I guess that makes it too for me an LA movie in that it's all these interesting characters. Cause, people who come to LA usually want to be here. They had goals when they first got here. They may have changed over the years.
Then they
Life may have
might be
beaten
to
them
leave.
down. And it's like, to me, that also makes it a very LA story. All these characters are trying to find their like sort of foothold in the world they want to live in, and it's a struggle. And that for me is very LA.
It
So
is.
much so.
It's very like western half of the US. Like I didn't realize that until I left the Midwest, where people just kind of were like born and stayed in the same house their whole life.
That's
When
right.
I moved to Phoenix, because like my entire group of friends, pretty much like by the time the pandemic hit, most of them had moved to other places and were leaving, and so Phoenix started to become more expensive than it's still cost of living is still way better than LA. Otherwise, I'd be in LA. But
I hear you.
seems like people come west for their dreams, and then sometimes they can't afford it, or they leave because of the weather or whatever it is. And so I kind of related to that a little bit when I was rewatching Jackie Brown over the years too. Another person I love in the film is Bridget Fonda. I think
Oh, she's great.
she's someone who never really got her due. I feel like we always liked her, we enjoyed her, but we don't realize just how good she is. And in this movie, I mean, your heart breaks for her, but also the way she commands and manipulates, and she's wonderful.
And I love that surreal moment where she's, lounging, smoking a bowl, watching TV, and it's her dad in Dirty, was it, sorry, it was in the movie, A Crazy Larry, Dirty, I'm blanking on the title, the Peter Fonda movie. It's just so funny. There's little moments, a lot of those little moments that you can tell Tarantino's having fun, like little references, Yeah, she's great in this too. Yeah, she's great. Yeah, and there's not really, I mean, even like, even the characters of minor roles. I'm thinking of, Max Cherry's enforcer guy, was it Ray Lister, played by Ray Lister Jr. It's like, I need to find Ordell. All right, find him. How? That's what I do. And they never
Yes.
explain it. He just does it. I love
Yeah.
that. That's what makes it like less, another movie, a lesser movie would have had all the steps of him like tracking down Ordell and the clever plot points. He almost hear the studio executive when give the note, oh, let's make sure we know how he finds them. Like, who cares? He just
Yeah.
finds them, And I
He
love
just
that.
does.
He just
Yes.
does.
Absolutely. And that goes back to like why we love Elmore Leonard's book so much.
Yeah.
You know, a line of dialogue tells you more about a person than 3 pages of, backstory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I really do think that, at least Leonard saw that they honor the spirit of his books because that's what they all are. They're hang books, What you love is the voice. You love the, how he describes people and their motivations, not so much the plot. I actually can't remember the plots very well, this books. I don't really care.
No.
I remember the people and what they do to each other, and how they
Yeah.
hang.
Yeah,
So
I
that's good
was
too.
thinking of that because recently I did an episode, I don't know if it was, well, I guess it was a year ago now on Elmore Leonard's Westerns. And they kind of,
Oh,
some
that's
of them
cool.
get a
That's right.
little like convoluted and,
Yeah.
but you remember the characters and you remember just certain moments. Like I
Yeah.
think one of my favorites of his was Freaky Deaky. And
Oh, yeah.
yeah, and like that one, gun to my head, I couldn't tell you the whole plot, but I could tell you little
Exactly.
bits about it. And I also love that this time we got to see the characters he mentions in a bunch of books, Ray Nicolette's in a few, and
Yeah.
Ordell, and of course, yeah, they're all kind of,
Yeah.
Lewis Gara is in a couple.
Yeah, who were in the Switch originally. It's funny, it's
Yes.
like they refer almost they make a reference to that at some point, like, oh, Hollywood took our story and did like some weird thing with it, which is kind of funny, it's very meta. And yeah, it's and I love the you mentioned earlier about Ray Nicolette appearing in Out of Sight. And I love that at some point, like we had almost had an Elmore Leonard verse happening, almost kind of like, characters drifting around. And it almost happened. That late 90s were a good time to be an Elmore Leonard fan. Get Shorty was great. And then these two were like getting Jackie Brown came next, I think. And then it was Out of Sight. I was like, wow, they're really doing these books justice finally. That was kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly. Well, are
So.
there any other LA touchstones or things that you love in this?
Again, I mentioned the South Bay of it all, and I was curious about what was still around. Like, they tore down Max Cherry's Bale Bosma shop. That's gone.
Oh.
They've seriously remodeled the Del Amo Mall, which I'm bummed about because I wanted to see it. I want to
Yeah.
go roll up and have an Acuna Boys soda and hang out at the mall and see a movie with Max Cherry, but that's not going to
Yeah,
happen
let's
now.
go hang out in the food court, right?
Yeah,
Like,
yeah, yeah. I mean, and there's that, but also, I mean, it's just related to me. It's like L.A. has a soundtrack, and Tarantino is so gifted at creating these soundtracks. And this is one of the movies that really the characters interact with the soundtrack in a big way. It feels like that's a very important, almost like it's part of their character, who they like, listen to, what they're responding to,
Especially on the way to the big showdown at the
Yeah.
mall with the switching of the money and the beach
Absolutely.
towel bags, like all, I think we see three or so different cars and they're all listening to different music and
Yes.
it says
Yeah.
so much. Like she's listening to I Play the Street Life, or he's
Yeah.
listening to Delphonics, she's listening to Midnight Confessions, and I mean,
Right.
it's
And then of
great.
course the Across 110th Street's a recurring theme, which at
Yeah.
first, of course, Harlem, not an LA thing. However, being in this movie, driving around your car, jamming to that song, makes it an LA movie. Like the idea of in a
Yes.
car, you're driving around, hearing your things you love, music you love, and you create your own soundtrack. That to me is super LA. That is like, I mean, I didn't have a car until I moved here. Back in Philly, I was always in, bus and a subway. Here, you kind of have to have one. And the music is a big deal. It can actually make this place seem a little more sane than it is if you have the right soundtrack. So that I loved. And it was, I noticed this watch, rewatching it this time, it really jumped out at me. Wow, he's doing so much with the soundtrack that, as sort of weighs into the characters' brains. It's kind of cool.
It
That's
is,
very LA.
yeah. The first time I went to LA as an adult, it was like on the Saturday night, it was the first time I hung out with Priscilla Page, and all we did was we drove around and
Yeah.
listened to music, and it was just such an LA kind of thing to do. And I think we drove around 3 hours, so we heard she likes to make CDs still. So I think we heard the
Awesome.
same CD like over and over and over again. And but yeah, it makes it an LA experience. My friends love to curate their drives to the New Beverly. Travis will share what he listened to on the way or something.
Yeah, I mean that's more since I moved here, I make a monthly soundtrack of like things that I'm listening to. Even if it also pins down moments in my brain where I'll listen to, oh, 5 years ago, March, 2020, here's what I was listening to. And it's amazing how much it brings you back. So yeah,
It
that
does.
I think no one director does that kind of thing, has that kind of soundtrack mean so much. It's not about licensing and who's the new pop star to jump put this. This is like old school stuff that he, has really thought about. So that was very LA. Yeah, to me, really the landmarks are not the capital LA landmarks, right? We all see in most movies. Again, highly specific, highly odd, unusual, which is also what I appreciate about, I guess, Pulp Fiction before that. And it's lesser, Reservoir Dogs is almost like it's sort of more, it is pieces of it, but Pulp Fiction, you definitely see more of LA. And Jackie Brown is like, wow, this is a real place. From Hermosa Beach to, Torrance, all these places that when you see them in real life, years later, it's pretty incredible. It's like, wow, it's not a set. This is real. And that's kind of interesting. I'm a big place person as for in terms of movies. So when it's real and not generic, I'm always gonna like spark to it.
Well, that's kind of what I'm trying to do in this episode is talk to people about movies that are shot there and take place there and showcase just the story of LA and how different it is from place to place. And from block to block.
It is, the truest thing I ever heard about this town is it's 88 little towns stitched together and they're all very different. They don't often get along someplace, it's just bizarre. But it's also wonderful because you can go anywhere and, meet all kinds of folks and get all kinds of adventures and what have you. That's kind of cool.
Exactly. It is wonderful. Well, Duane, I want to thank you so much for doing this. This was such a pleasure.
It's a blast, Jen. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Well, I am thrilled to have one of my good friends, Kate Hagen, with me. You've heard her on the podcast so many times. She is the senior VP of the Blacklist. I'm so proud of her. She's a wonderful freelance writer. I know she has some new projects she wants to talk about that just came out, and I can't wait to do that as well. And we're going to be also talking about a city we love and movies we love. So, Kate, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Jen. So great to be back on the show. I'm always glad to chat with you. And today we get to talk about one of my very favorite movies of all time, which is always a thrill. I'll also direct all of your wonderful podcast listeners to check out. I have a new essay in the Vinegar Syndrome cinematography release of Female Perversions, which is out as of February 1st. So if you dig my vibe, that's a good one to check out. Vinegar Syndrome cinematography has been doing great work, particularly on some of these unsung 80s and 90s movies.
And also Little Darlings, right?
Yeah, that was super fun. That was out last year, and I just can't believe that some of these movies that I thought would never be on disc have arisen from the grave. We do love to see
We
it.
do. Missing movies we've talked about on the podcast. So yes, and a film that I think, was missing from some streaming services and kind of has picked up in love. It's a cult film, an LA classic, contemporary classic movie, Miracle Mile. So Kate, when did you first become aware of this one?
So I was late to the party on this one. I
Me
definitely feel,
too.
yeah, it feels like it was one of those movies that nobody talked about, and then suddenly everybody started talking about. I had been aware of it because I'm a really big ER fan, and so many years ago, going down the Anthony Edwards rabbit hole, I was like, oh, I'm aware this movie exists with him called Miracle Mile. I can't remember what sort of made me be like, I gotta see that. But I can tell you, I did rent it from an LA institution that is no longer with us, Eddie Brandt Saturday Matinee in North Hollywood.
Ooh.
Really cool video store, 80,000 tapes out on the floor. That they did
Wow.
not unfortunately survive the pandemic, but Quentin Tarantino now owns the collection, so they're in good hands. But I rented it on VHS from Eddie Brandt's, and it's one of those movies. And guys, to talk about this movie, we have to kind of spoil this movie. So if you haven't seen it, I would say go watch it and then listen to our chat about it. But I was kind of just like stunned and amazed after watching it. I was so blown away. The movie is so propulsive and has a really sort of shocking ending, even though it feels a bit inevitable. But I will tell you, the tape I had from Eddie Brandt had the strange alternate ending, which we can
Ooh.
talk more about later, which I don't think is quite as strong as the actual theatrical ending. My friend Mariah Gates talked about Miracle Mile. The first time she ever saw it, she immediately started it again. She had to watch it back to back 2 times. I did not do that, but I understand where that impulse comes from because I don't really think there's another movie quite like this movie.
Yeah, I think the only I've only done that a couple times where I needed to watch it again. After Hours was one. I think this one, the ending hits so hard that I can't watch it immediately after, but I do understand because this is, one of those huge left-hand turn movies. You think you're watching like a rom-com and it's kind of cute at the beginning. There's like ethereal sounding music. And then all of a sudden, oh my God, he answers a phone call in the phone booth, and payload is coming, something's going on, and the world is going to end in X number of minutes. And how do you react to that? How do you get other people to believe you that you're not full of shit? It is, yeah, it's such a good one. And you talked about the ending, and I know this movie had been written like 10 years before. It was one of those like the best on, kind of like what you do at the Blacklist. Like, oh my God, why isn't anyone making this wonderful script? And part of it was they wanted a different director, and the writer director wanted to have control, which is good because Anthony Edwards talked about how many people wanted to change the ending. They wanted a happy ending, and he stuck to his guns. He knew the story he was going to tell, and yes, it is just a brilliant film. So, love to know more about your love of it. Yeah.
I think the movie doesn't work as well as it does if that big swing of an ending isn't there.
Yes, not at
I
all.
think, I know at one point Steve DeJarnette, the writer and director, it was pitched that it was all a dream,
Yeah.
which is one of the worst cop-out endings I can think of.
Oh my God.
But the fact that Steve DeJarnette stuck to his guns and I believe bought the movie back from Warner Brothers, who owned it at one point, so that he
Yes, for
could take it.
25,000 or something.
Yeah, absolutely bananas. That he was so committed, and he knew this is what ending the movie needed. I had a totally surreal moment earlier this year. I've had the good fortune of getting to see Miracle Mile 2 times theatrically, and I saw it this past summer again, during American Cinematheque's Bleak Week. It was Joe Dante's personal print of Miracle Mile, which was.
Oh,
But then a bunch of the cast and crew showed up. Jeanette Goldstein, Denise Crosby, Steve DeJarnette, Paul Haslinger from Tangerine Dream, which was like a life highlight for me
oh
as a
my God.
fan. But
Yeah, we were gonna do an episode just on Tangerine Dreams scores. My God.
we'll get there. Watch with Jen, listeners, one of these days. But the Q&A, if I can't recommend seeing this with Steve DeJarnette enough, he's such a rock star and such a spirited character. But the Q&A sort of devolved into him talking to the cast members who were in the back of the theater, and completely unprompted, Denise Crosby's like, "Yeah, this movie was around town. The script, everybody loved it. It was kind of like on the Blacklist before the Blacklist." And like 3 people knew I was there, and everybody just like looked at me, and I was like, "I don't know, you guys." I actually showed this movie last year at our screenwriters lab, because I think it's a perfect sort of artistic auteur statement from Steve DeJarnette.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great lesson in just being committed to your vision. It was featured in a 1983 article in AFI magazine about the most beloved unproduced screenplays in town that kind of predated The Blacklist. Other stuff like Jacob's Ladder, At Close Range, Total Recall was included there, but then a bunch of movies that never ended up getting made.
Wow.
I do think about the fact that they really tried to make this a segment of the Twilight Zone movie, and thank God that they didn't, because we
Oh
can.
gosh, that movie is so doomed and like, oh, yeah.
A cursed film that this
Yes.
movie didn't need to be associated with. But you know, thank God for Hemdale. Thank God for Hemdale being like, we will take a big bold swing on this. You know, they put out some fantastic stuff in the 80s that was really bold. I made a little list of some Hemdale movies I love. Strange Behavior, that's a weird one. Terminator, Return of the Living Dead,
Yeah.
River's Edge, Outcome
Yes.
Strange. Yeah.
Outcome Strange.
Some really interesting, unique stuff. But I don't know, like Jen was saying, this movie is so unique and it really pulls the rug out from under you. You have this like first half of the movie that's this dreamy kind of sweet rom-com. And then Anthony Edwards picks up the phone at Johnny's at 3rd and Fairfax in LA and everything goes to hell in a handbasket. And I love that the movie makes you question everything right along with the protagonist, and that we're kind of experiencing information as the protagonist is experiencing it. And I don't know, a lot of end of the world movies, I feel like it's like, oh, we have to globally triangulate and we're going to Siberia and, you know, the space station. And this is just one guy, one night in Los Angeles. I think the after hours comparison is really apt. They really sort of feel yin and yang movies to me. Although it's so interesting, right? Like I would argue that the ending of Miracle Mile is more hopeful, even though everyone dies. after hours, which you're just back in the rat race. But really great
Yes.
companion films for one another. I don't know. This movie is both so charming and so totally destabilizing. It's really unforgettable in terms of its emotional swings. And I think what I like about it too is it's a movie about Los Angeles that feels more akin to a normal Los Angeles than most LA movies. It's not a heightened reality. It's not a period film. It's not a sort of dream world vision of LA. It's just a guy. It's a trombone player. And he wants to go see this girl he likes at the Park La Brea apartments. Just really simple, straightforward sort of Los Angeles storytelling. Obviously, Steve DeJarnett makes incredible use of that whole Miracle Mile corridor over by LACMA. It's so cool to see Los Angeles truly in the middle of the night. You know, driving around LA late night, you do sort of feel like it's a ghost town. So I can only imagine what it felt like in the 80s to be, you know, driving around at 3 o'clock in the morning. I read an interview with Steve DeJarnett many years ago. Forgive me, folks, for not remembering what it was from, but he was talking about the art theater in Beverly Hills in LA used to do like all night marathons of things like Lubitsch comedies. So you'd like fall asleep in one Lubitsch comedy and wake up in the next and be like, well, it's basically the same plot. And then he talked about you'd like go outside at 5 o'clock in the morning and be like, this Los Angeles is completely different than any other Los Angeles I've ever gotten to experience. And I think that sort of motivated some of the writing of Miracle Mile. But I have to tell too, the cutest footnote to Miracle Mile and to any movie. Some of you guys might know the story, some of you
Yes.
may not. So the leads of the film are Anthony Edwards and Mayor Whittingham, and the movie is about finding your person even at the end of the world. And Mayor Whittingham and Anthony Edwards talked about the fact that they were always attracted to each other, but they were both married to other people.
Yeah.
Did not time out, you know, the attraction was there, but things just didn't work out. So I believe it was in 2018 when this got put on Blu-ray, which was kind of the moment that it hit the zeitgeist. They reconnected to do the commentary track for Miracle Mile. They were finally both at a place in their lives where they can make it work, and they are now married.
I
Cutest
know.
footnote.
I know. And that was, yes, because everybody was like, okay, we're going to be fine in the pandemic. They are married, the Miracle Mile couple. And I love what you were saying too about how usually end of the world movies, you're following the, oh, we need to triangulate a strike and do this and travel because we're in that movie for like a little bit. That we're in so many different movies in Miracle Mile, just like every neighborhood in LA, every street in LA is like a different planet, essentially. Kind of New York is the same way. This is one of those things. So after he takes this call, you know, we're with these people and we're like, okay, we need to make a list of the great thinkers and what, you know, we need canned goods and we need to do this and here's where we're going. And he just decides, a couple other people had made this decision too. Like, no, I want to stay with the people I love. he makes the decision no, and he gets off while it's still in motion, which is amazing, this truck that he is in. And I think this movie continues to do that again and again and again. Anthony Edwards basically carries this whole movie. He's in like every scene. Mare Winningham is great too, of course, and they're, adorable together, but she isn't really in it as much as he is. And I can't imagine like the emotional stress and how exhausting this would have been to play, the level of energy, the high stakes of what they're doing. I mean, these all-night shoots would have been bit draining anyway, but by the time like they end, I can't imagine what that would have been like. So I do love that they were connecting while they were in this heightened of a situation. That's really cool. And you mentioned LACMA and where these things are. When I've been watching some of these movies now that I've been to LA so many times in the last couple of years, like I just watched The Driver too. And so The Driver and Miracle Mile, as they're moving around, I'm like, oh, I know where that is. I know where that is. So it's great. This is a film. I also love seeing things at night where the streets are a little bit emptier and it's a little quieter because you're right. It is a different LA than you get during rush hour, for example. Yes.
It's such a, and it's like, I don't know, it's such just a different Los Angeles too. I've lived in LA 2012 and the degree to which the city has shifted even in that time. And then to watch a movie from the 80s, you're like, oh my God, take me back. Okay, don't be creepy, watch with Jen listeners, but I do live off of Third Street in Los Angeles. So the Miracle Mile corridor is kind of like my zone of the city. And I had a really surreal moment. I saw this movie. It was a midnight screening at TCM Film Festival a couple of years ago. And I went with some friends and I dropped them home and it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm coming down Third Street. I'm headed back to my place. And I see a guy running down the middle of Third Street, which guys, if you've never been to LA, Third Street is not like a Melrose or a Sunset, but it's one of the bigger streets in town. He is running down the median of Third
Oh
Street
my
at 3
God.
o'clock in the morning in head to toe, full reflective gear. You could not miss him for Mars. So he was doing a safety moment, but it was so perfect for having just seen Miracle Mile. It felt kind of like the moment in the movie when they go back to Johnny's and the coyote is just standing there. Of like, yeah, it's LA. I kind of know what the deal is, but then every once in a while you see something, you're just like, well, that's fucking weird. I don't know what to do with that. But this is a great movie to see with people too. People who've never seen it are truly shocked by it in a way that
It's
things
a great
do.
audience movie.
Yeah, and I think it's because, as you said, Jen, Anthony Edwards is so relatable and such a sweetheart in this. Both of the leads are so atypical, I feel like, for movies from this era. They're both kind of like nerdy people. They're very genuine and earnest in the sort of yuppie-fied Reagan 80s. And I think sometimes about the sliding doors of Anthony Edwards' career and the fact that had this movie been a hit at the time, I think he would have been a major 90s star. Obviously, he carried ER on his back for 10 seasons also. He did just fine. But I have thought about the alternate reality where like this movie makes him a gigantic star along with Top Gun. But he's terrific, man. Underrated actor. Everybody in this cast is underrated. There's so many great character actors. Mikael T. Williamson, Olan Jones, Denise Crosby, the guy whose name I'm blanking on, who does all the drugs at the end of the world, who's been in a bunch of great stuff, Jeanette Goldstein. And it's just so nice to see like a crew of actors that look like regular degular people also.
No, and you mentioned the 80s era and just the look of the film and the feel of it. And I kind of miss this. I find myself writing and going back to like 80s and 90s, 70s, 80s, and 90s films the most. And I think it's because that's the era like I would have come of age or that I saw these movies around this time period. Miracle Mile, I came late to. I believe I saw it the summer before the pandemic happened. And then I watched it again at the beginning, kind of like a little gallows humor a little bit. But I've seen it maybe 3 or 4 times by now. It hasn't lost any of its magic, but that first time I made the mistake of watching it at night, I didn't know like what was going to happen or where it was going to go. I was like, oh, this is amazing. You know, the music and Tangerine Dream, and it's so romantic. And then what the fuck? I knew that there was something with the end of the world, but I guess I did not know where it was going. So that was an amazing experience. But I do miss this. Like when I was watching it this time, I was just thinking about the shot, and I found like a still and I shared it of Anthony Edwards in the phone booth, and just how much I love phones in movies, especially phone booths, because I wrote there's something super romantic about phone booths in cinema. They're vulnerable, they're honest, they pin you and your emotions in place. There's a time crunch to encourage you to have the guts to cut through the bullshit. They're bittersweet and they can lift and devastate you fast, as in Miracle Mile, because at the beginning, he's just a dude who slept through his alarm at the hotel. He missed taking his girl dancing, and he goes and he tries to call her, and it's a few hours later, and he's devastated and he feels so bad. And then the next call happens, and you're like, oh my God, yes. So I miss this sort of bygone era. You had to actually call people. You met people for real. It's a different time. Yeah.
Oh, it really is. I hate to sound like a boomer, but I certainly not an original thought either. Guys, I think cell phones maybe ruined movies.
They did, yes.
There's just, you think about a movie like this and how many things would not exist in the movie if cell phones also
Yeah.
exist. And the fact that it just has a set of stakes that are so different because people just can't pick up a device in their pocket and make it all better. You're so right, Jen, about phone booths being both romantic and devastating, all in good measure. You know, many of us millennial babies have memories of like, okay, well, my parents are just going to drop me off at the movie theater and then I'm going to use a payphone, call them when I'm ready to get picked up. Which saying that to somebody today, they'd be like, that's insane. And you're like, no, actually, it was better. Let's go back there. That makes it better. But I think too, that's getting at what I was saying about like the sort of Los Angeles that doesn't exist anymore. This idea that you could go to Johnny's as an all-night diner. The pandemic has been really rough on all-night diners in Los Angeles.
I love diners.
I know. And, you know, just this idea that you could go on this one night caper through Los Angeles, whereas now Los Angeles certainly doesn't look like it did in Miracle Mile, although there are certain views. I'm going to forget the name of the address of the building on Wilshire, where there's that great sort of classic noir shot of Anthony Edwards looking up at the gigantic building where the heliopad that he's supposed to get to is at, and it feels so sort of mythic, for this just little scrappy movie from Hemdale about the end of the world. And I think there's a lot of touches like that in Miracle Mile, that make it, sometimes greater than the sum of its parts in a very major way.
100%. And I like all the different people they come into contact with. Everybody feels like they have their own lives, that they're fully three-dimensional. Like you kind of wonder about some of the people in the diner, and then just, you know, it would be like a punchline. Like, as much as, oh my God, I love Speed, and we're going to be talking about Speed, you know, Toon Man in the car, it would be like, oh, I need a ride really quickly, and he needs a ride in this movie, and it happens to be a man who has stolen things, and you know, and then we get into some situations. But that is somebody with his own. We want to know his story, want to know everyone's story. There's a dignity to it. Like even Mayor Winningham, her relatives who had a fight like decades ago and they haven't spoken, they live in like the same building. It's amazing, that whole thing. And so you feel invested, you see why she's invested. Like, wait a minute, they've come together. So that kind of shows you the gravity of what's going on. Yeah, it's just, I think it's good. It cares about its people. Sometimes in these end of the world movies, especially in the 90s, as these would become more prevalent as we approach Y2K, people were, you know, cardboard cutouts.
It's really true. And, you know, I think it's funny you mentioned those two characters in particular because those are the two moments in the movie that get me the most, even more so than the ending, are Michael T. Williamson when he goes to find his sister and says, and then they end up getting killed by the police, and they have a really tragic death moment together that kind of stops the movie and stops you dead in your tracks as you watch the very tragic moment. And then on the other side of that coin, you have Mayor Winningham's estranged grandparents who have hated each other for decades, and they decide they want to go spend the end of the world together eating a Cantor's sandwich. Isn't that the best any of us can hope for? Just like,
yeah, we hope.
Favorite person at Cantor's when the end of the world comes. I'll take that, certainly.
Exactly. I know. And there's something really, like, again, gallows humor about watching it now in this administration with everything going on. And just like, I think it was the day we heard people that were in charge of the nukes had been fired, and you're just like, what is going on? And so I just thought it was Valentine's Day, and I'm like, you know what? This is good. I'm with loved ones, and this is all like the best you can do. And yeah, so I think Miracle Mile really gets to the heart of everything, and contrasted with the absurdity of the situation, which weirdly is, I guess, from the Cold War era, wasn't that absurd either, but yeah, it doesn't seem that far-fetched anymore, which is kind of bananas. Yes.
World, what a time.
I know, what has happened? Yes.
Who would have thought the movie about nuclear destruction from the 80s would become so important to this particular moment in time?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's so interesting seeing people's reactions to the endings of this movie, because I've watched it with people that are upset, that are upset that I have shown it to them and are just like, can't grapple with the fact that like the end is coming for all of us in some fashion. But I find the ending of this movie to be so, so deeply romantic. I mean, the idea, I remember the first time I watched this, and when he finally, when Anthony Edwards' character finally finds Julie again, and you're like, oh my God, they're together. They did it. Like, you want to scream at the screen. But isn't it the best that's any of us can hope for, being close to your nearest and dearest right at the end? Like, you know, while the world literally burns, it's just me and you in this sinking helicopter. That's it, kid. But you know, it's a mileage may vary movie. I wish more movies took big swings with an ending like this, though. I'll give a movie like an additional star just for taking a bold swing and being committed to that idea rather than like a sort of mealy mouthed ending.
Exactly. I'll take ambition over, you know, blah, anytime. Even if the ambition doesn't work 100%, they're at least trying, goddammit. Yes.
No, absolutely trying. And I think this movie really succeeds. And I think the fact that it's been so, so widely rediscovered and so beloved, there's a brand new 4K coming. There's a fantastic Walter Chaw book about it. Like,
yes,
it has never been more popular than it is right now in 2025. And isn't that cool that a movie can have a shelf life like this?
Yes, and I'm so glad you mentioned Walter, because he's the one I'm going to be talking about, The Driver and Hickey and Boggs, and I think one other one. He's probably going to mention a lot of other movies that Walter Hill did, but that's perfect. So you mentioned, we should probably wrap on that, you talked about seeing this with an alternate ending. So what was that like?
So you guys can read about it on the internet too, but based on my recollection, it's basically the same ending of the movie, but instead of the sort of smash to black and then the sound of the nuclear bomb going off, you see Anthony Edwards and Mayor Winningham kind of turn into diamonds.
Oh, jeez.
Which is, they talk about, it's kind of a motif in the movie.
So
it's not totally a piece, but to me, it feels like that was their attempt at a solution, an attempt at a happy ending. But it reads as so corny and so sort of disingenuous, whereas the actual ending of the movie hits like a ton of bricks. But to find it, I think it's on YouTube. I do have to share one fact about this movie that I only learned today, which is very cool. One of my other favorite films of 1988 is Joan Micklyn Silver's Crossing Delancey.
Oh, yeah. Coming to Criterion.
Oh, so exciting. but I did not realize Crossing Delancey and Miracle Mile share a cinematographer, Theo Van de Sand. So thank you, Theo Van de Sand, for your contributions to the cinema of 1988.
That's amazing. Yes. Isn't it cool when you find that out, like, that these movies that you love have the same, that have something in common that you are not expecting. Yeah. That for me, 1987 is a touchstone. And so, Moonstruck and Broadcast News actually opened on the same day, which is incredible to me. And it's like, those are two of my
Whoa.
favorite movies. I actually saw Moonstruck in the theater, first one I remember, seeing with like actual live action people. Yes.
That's so cool, Jen. I didn't know that was like your first grown-up movie in theaters. What a great one to
Yes,
start on.
yeah, with my mom and grandma, so it was like three generations of Italian American women. So I have a lot of love for that. So I love the Theo Van Sant it all and of it all, I should say, and Miracle Mile. So other favorite LA movies you want to give a shout out to before I let you go?
Oh gosh, so
So
many.
many.
Everybody
Valley
needs to
Girl, I
watch.
know is
Yeah.
one.
Everybody needs to watch Los Angeles Plays Itself, first of all.
Yes.
Incredible sort of essay film about Los Angeles on film. I cannot recommend it enough. As you mentioned, Jen, Valley Girl, perfect Los Angeles movie. I think time has been exceedingly kind to Valley Girl, even compared to some of the other LA 80s teen movies. Obviously, Mulholland Drive. Obviously, LA Confidential. I'm gonna shout out 1984's Angel, which has
Okay.
some quote unquote challenging elements in it for 2025, but I think is a really lovely movie about a ragtag group of survivors on Hollywood Boulevard, and you get a glimpse at Hollywood Boulevard in the peak of the 80s that is really incredible. Oh goodness. Now, of course, I'm like, have I seen a movie set in Los Angeles? The Long Goodbye. So many Elton
Yes.
films, The Player,
Yes.
Alison Anders, incredible, Mi Vida
Oh my
Loca.
goodness, perfect, yeah.
Oh my goodness. Boys in the Hood. There's so many. Like you could just throw a rock and find infinite. Real Women Have Curves.
Oh, I love that film.
That talk about a movie that's due for some cultural reappraisal. Although the
Yeah.
museum had a really lovely exhibit for Patricia Cardozo at one point, which was very cool. But yeah, watch Los Angeles Plays Itself, discover some LA movies kind of outside and off the beaten path. Oh my God, I didn't even mention Heat, one of the greatest Los Angeles movies of all time. There's a lot. I'll stop talking now.
No, you mentioned so many, but I think also just start with, yeah, Los Angeles Plays Itself and go from there. Well, Kate, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Jen, I love having these conversations. I can't wait to see what other LA movies everybody talks about. And we promise one day we will do that Tangerine Dream scores episode, guys. We'll get
Yes,
there.
absolutely. Well, Walter, I am so thrilled to have you back. It's been far too long. Walter Cha is my brilliant friend. You've heard him on the podcast. He is a critic at Film Freak Central. He is a film professor at UC Denver, and I'm so proud of him. And he's also the author of A Walter Hill Film. So how are you doing, Walter?
We're all buckled down and gonna ride out this current wave of fascism and hope not to be too. I don't know. I mean,
Yeah.
it's a weird question to ask anymore. I always feel bad. I was like, how are you? I kind of know how you are, but
Yeah.
just at this moment, I'm doing great. How are you at
I
this
am
moment?
glad to be talking to you. We were talking off
Same.
air just so people understand our state of mind. And Walter had this brilliant thought where he said, his former protest is showing up for work every day,
Yeah.
And that's really all we can do. Just keep plugging away.
Yeah, I would like to curl up in the fetal position, but I figure, I can't radicalize people if I do that. So
Yeah.
here I am.
Free
And
some
it's
minds, inspire some.
it really helps too to be in the company of people like you and some of our friends who are, the same kind of, you don't feel isolated then anymore. And I think that's
No.
important right now too,
Yeah, a sense of community for sure.
Definitely.
Well, I was thrilled to have you back. Of course, it's been a long time. You're one of the busiest guys I know. You wrote a brilliant, just completely well-researched, I know it took so much time and effort, book on Walter Hill. So when we were putting together this episode of LA movies and devoted to our friends in LA and to kind of you know, raised some spirits with the fires recently. I was glad that you reached out and you suggested talking about The Driver and Hickey and Boggs and sharing some of your wisdom about Walter Hill. I had a really fun experience last summer. I was house sitting for our friend Jordan Harper for a little bit, and he owned the 4K of The Driver, and I had Priscilla Page, another friend, over, and we were watching it and in LA, and you know, and it was very cool. And Priscilla, being her hilarious self, she was sneaking photos on her cell phone, and then later she posted, like, Jen has no idea, but I've been taking pictures of Ryan O'Neill's chest hair. So I was glad to be able to relive The Driver experience with you.
Yeah, it's actually the second movie that he did with Ryan O'Neill. He did a TV movie called The Thief Who Came to Dinner Ryan O'Neill. And you know, there's a scene in The Thief Who Came to Dinner where O'Neill drives a car, not like a, you know, criminal or, you know, a professional, but he drives kind of an interesting looking car out of a parking garage, which is a scene that's repeated in The Driver. And I think, you know, that's probably why he saw something in O'Neill for this role. You know, O'Neill, he's a beautiful man, but he's not like traditionally thought of, I think, for a lot of good reasons, probably, as a great actor. He's certainly got a genial personality. It comes through well on screen. I love him in Paper Moon. You know,
my faves. Yep.
Yeah, I'm not maligning Ryan O'Neill, except for him being a bad human being.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Except for all that stuff.
We're not going to hang out with him. We're talking about a good actor. Yeah.
No, I'm not going to be happy if he marries my daughter, but, you know. Anyway, I think he chose him because he's kind of a cipher in a way that he's able to play somebody that's not easily readable, and there may not be great depths, you know, perhaps to him. Like, he's not complex on screen, no matter how complicated all of us are. Again, I'm trying not to malign him, but I'm just saying, you know, there's a reason that he's perfect for The Driver, because in The Driver, he's really kind of a cipher. He's unknowable beyond a certain depth, and it's perfect for this film. It's kind of an American art house film masquerading as a, you know, blockbuster action movie. Like Bullet, I think people were expecting something like Bullet, Peter Yates' film. And Hill was a second unit guy on Bullet. He describes his contribution as essentially directing traffic, like literally not letting people drive onto set. But he took a lot from these experiences, from reading the script for Point Blank. That was a really big influence for him for this film. And, you know, it sort of taught him. It said, you know, he said that it made him think about writing movie scripts as haiku, as just contributing the very minimum to convey emotions and images through his writing. If you ever read his screenplays, they're very staccato after a certain point. It's fascinating to see them. But yeah, he made The Driver with this idea that none of the characters would really have names. The writer named character is called The Driver, right?
The player,
played by Isabella Gianni in her English language debut, which she was initially really excited about. She's like, this is my big breakthrough.
Yes.
People could not wait not to see this movie. And they just stayed away in droves. It really flopped. And so later she blamed Walter Hill and said, I was lied to. You know, this is a little art movie. This has nothing to do with a blockbuster movie and whatever. But I think she's wonderful in it.
She's really great
and enigmatic. But, you know, to your topic about great LA films, it's one of the earliest, I think, certainly for me it was, visions of LA at night, sort of the neon lit, wet streets, you know, white lights bouncing off of it. LA really, for me, in my imagination, is sunny palm trees, Hollywood sign, the opening of Beverly Hills Cop, right? When he's driving down Rodeo Drive and looking at all the tiny dogs and the high heels and the leather. And, you know, that's my impression of LA, or the opening of Three's Company, I guess, when I was younger, with going to the San Diego Zoo. That's California. It's all of it's encapsulated in those images. And for him to shoot almost exclusively at night for this film, where it's just it's empty, and it's lit by like diegetic lighting. Is that what it's called? It's just lit by lights that seem like they just exist there. And you know, I got the same feeling years and years, decades later, when I watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, when Tarantino was, you know, showing his Hollywood, his memories of old Hollywood, and just this feeling of like both strangeness and familiarity, I think. And there's a whole genre of LA noir, right? You mentioned Jordan Harper, the great Jordan Harper. You know, he kind of writes some sunny noir in places that are set kind of in the daytime and stuff. And there's a whole genre of LA noir, and Hickey and Boggs, which is directed by Robert Culp, but it's Walter Hill's first produced screenplay.
Yeah.
Would fall into that category. So there's two visions, I think, of LA as a place with a really seamy underbelly, with you know, the hard-boiled detectives and the entire genre of it. And I think between the two of them, for me, emerges this really interesting portrait of LA as unknowable in a way of presenting kind of a beautiful front, when underneath there's it's almost David Lynchian in a way. Underneath there's this teeming criminal underworld. There's a sense of unrest and instability. In the driver particularly, there's a sense of like strangeness. It's almost a spiritual journey through the film, if you follow it. It reminds me of Black Orpheus, you know, the Camus film, where in the daytime it's carnival, right? But at nighttime, mm-hmm. there's this really kind of mysterious spiritual thrum that goes through the streets. It's not always in tune with what's happening in the daytime. I think the driver has since become obviously a pretty popular cult film for a lot of reasons, I think, but you know, for gearheads especially. But for me, it's always been this sort of like almost supernatural movie that feels like it, or Thief is another movie that feels like this to me. Mm-hmm. That feels almost not real. It's like a parallel reality. I'm not being articulate, but it's like it feels like it runs parallel to what we know. It's uncanny.
It exists.
Quite beautiful.
Yeah, somewhere between like dark and light, there's the neon, kind of the reflection of light, or it's caught in between a little bit, that neon haze of, headlights. And also the way it's stripped down to its essence. You brought up a haiku, which was really good, I thought. Mm. And, you know, stripping everything down to the genre, like we have a cop, we have the connection, and this happens and that. But it takes it in a different way, a different avenue than you were expecting when you go in. I think a lot of interest in this movie kind of rose up after Drive, of course, the Refn movie. And of course he denied, like, oh, I never saw The Driver. And it's like, you absolutely saw The Driver. Yes. And so I think, but you brought up Thief, and I think that's a good one. I would put this with like Thief and To Live and Die in LA. There's a little bit of a through line with those. They get a little more complicated and complicated and complicated, but the same spiritual idea goes definitely through Thief and this film, for sure.
Yeah, and I love that you bring up the idea of stripped down again. It's you know, LA is so maximalist,
yes,
right? You know, not only in its appearance, but it's like it's space that it takes up in our imagination.
Yeah.
But when you see a minimalist view of LA, it's really kind of mesmerizing in a way, or you know, or like the Venice of Don't Look Now, as opposed to the Venice of Summertime or the Venice of Imagination, which is just a place of shadows, mm-hmm. and a place of like secret transactions, and you know, this massive opening chase sequence, which is still, I think, maybe unequaled in many ways.
It's phenomenal. What it is. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's so good. But even the idea that as you're sleeping, there's this sort of world, this frantic, antic world that's happening outside of your vision, outside of your ability to see. There's something about it that's ethereal, you know, almost for a crime movie, and the impact of the chases, and, you know, no one's, in my mind, I'm jaded and biased, but, you know, I don't think anyone in American film during that period especially was the equal of Hill in terms of telling story through action. So the action is phenomenal, but yeah, then there's the conversations that they have where the player is playing the driver against, you know, all the stuff. And it turns out that the detective doesn't know enough to, it's just, the plot is so strange too. And it even really at the end is. Of it, you don't really know. Yeah.
It's so hard to follow. It took me like two watchings to be able to, wait, what happened with the money? Yes.
Exactly right. And then in the middle of it, there's this really kind of disturbing sequence in which the driver's handler, played by Ronnie Blakely, her name is the Connection, is attacked, is assaulted in a really intimate way, and the transaction about, like, you know, the conversation that she has with the driver, she's like, how'd the new girl work out? She did her job. Who'd you have to pay her off? Did it myself. It's not like you. Why am I here? Just like the staccato, almost emotionless kind of interaction. Yeah. And so suddenly to have this really emotionally violent scene in the middle of it is jarring. But, you know, all of it's
like the long goodbye again. And the Coke bottle.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The all of it's like, you know, it's all right by me. Then all of a sudden there's this jarring emotional thing. And the long goodbye is another really great example of an L.A. noir, of this really kind of, wow, it's a lot. It's more weird out here than you can imagine, right? I mean, all of a sudden, here's Arnold Schwarzenegger in a Speedo. Whoa, you know what's happening here? We're in some guy's office, right? So there's all this stuff. I think the driver is fascinating too for me, because it did so poorly that I think it would have ended his career, Hill's career, if he hadn't already been in the middle of shooting another movie. He'd already gone on to do The Warriors, which ended up being quite a large hit until Paramount pulled it out of the theaters after a few weeks, because of the violence that it was causing. Yeah. It's one of the great disasters that's turned out to be kind of all right for everyone involved. Hill was already writing Alien during the course of this as well. He was working on the Alien script. So he had a lot of, you know, sort of coals on the fire. It's a good lesson for aspiring filmmakers. Always have the next thing ready for when you're doing the one thing. Everyone was excited about The Driver until The Driver came out.
What's interesting too is what you were saying about the stuff happening at night. I live in downtown Phoenix area, and sometimes at like 2 a.m, 3 a.m, I will awaken to hear like roars of engines. We have a lot of drag racing that takes place around here. So it's kind of like, what's going on? Is Ryan O'Neill and company, are they, they're outside? But I like that. It also brings up what you were saying about a different side of LA, because this is just like Thief. LA at night is different. It's the diner version, or you go and you can order things that have simple ingredients and like eggs or eggs. Whereas if you go out to lunch at almost any restaurant during the day in LA, it has like, you know, 500 ingredients in something, you know, but it's apple smoked with this and like 35 spices. And you're like, can I just get something basic right now? And I that's love interesting.
That.
Yeah.
I love that, you know, and it reminds me of Miracle Mile as well. And that all night thing, right? And I love
it's discovering a different world.
Exactly right. And I love discovering those places like the diners in LA still that have been there for 60 years or 80 years or whatever. And you go there and you can, like you say, you can still get like a breakfast, you know, early bird special, still down. Whatever what it is. Yeah, exactly right. And it's under $100. really. But I think that's what's alluring to me about LA, and even more alluring to me about some of these films set in LA that show me a version of LA that I don't see, is that it never entirely seems real to me.
Yes.
You know, like Phoenix seems real to me. Denver seems real to me. Albuquerque seems real to me. LA seems not real to me, and not not real like Las Vegas, but not real in that I think I already developed a full sense of what LA was before I ever visited it. Like, you know, the TV film, right? I don't know if you had that experience when you first went, where it's like, I know this street, or I know this house.
It's a little surreal. I went like about six times in the last couple of years, a million times, but, and I got used to it, but yeah, you drive around and, wait a minute, I've seen this museum. Oh, this was in Miracle Mile, or I've seen.
Yeah.
It's like you're there, but you're not there. Kind of like when you're at Grand Canyon, you're experiencing it, but you're also thinking about later on, like I saw the Grand Canyon.
Like you're like visiting a dream that you've had your whole life. Like, you know, suddenly you're somewhere, and this is really, for me, the first time was a really shocking sense of deja vu.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm like, wait a minute. Is this Gremlins Chinese Theater? And what's weird about like some places is like, it's in a strip mall. You know,
exactly. Grauman's was not what I was expecting. Also, I was a little worried I was going to get mugged because of where he dropped me off. I'm like, I'm not getting out of the car here.
It's so weird, right? And it's like, there's like a guy dressed like RoboCop to take pictures, and there's a woman dressed like Marilyn Monroe there, and there's like, and it's filthy. And it smells like urine. It's
and Hollywood like five Boulevard. Guys want you to go see their buddy's band and handing out.
Everybody's trying to hand you a CD. Everyone's trying to hand you their CD. And then like across the street's the best bookstore of movie books ever. And then right next
Larry
to
it's Larry Edmonds.
Larry Edmonds. And then there's like a head shop right next to it. And then there's like postcards. It's like, it's almost too much. Like, you know, here's the house that I grew up in, and it's in the middle of the seamiest, you know, strip mall. Yes. And then here's the Walk of Fame, and here's Harry Belafonte. It's too much information for like culture junkies like yourself and like me in a way. So yeah, I mean, there's something about LA that's uncanny already. It's already part of our dream life. So then when you see like a version of LA done by a native where it's like, or by Vin Vendors, for instance, like in Allison Cities or whatever, where it's like an outsider's view of your dream life, it's almost like there's an interpretation of your unconscious in a way when you're watching The Driver that is like shocking to me. Every time I watch it, I feel like, oh, this is Los Angeles. You know, it always takes me a second for me to kind of lock into that. Similarly with Hickey and Boggs, he avoids all of these like landmarks and just goes into this really kind of dark place, you know, and
it's almost like they're allergic. I think it was Kim Morgan said it's like they're hung over from the sun.
Oh God, I love it. Yeah, I think almost nobody writes better about noir than Kim Morgan does. Really brilliant.
I don't know. I'm paraphrasing, but that's, I think in her new Beverly piece, she said something like that. And I was like, oh my God, that's perfect. Yeah.
You know, Charles Taylor wrote something about Hickey and Boggs too. That's like, I read it and I'm like, no one will ever write a better piece about this. I hate reading things like that. It's there's something that's really brilliant, I think, about avoiding every expectation of something that's already so much a part of your dream life. And that's what I think both of those films do too. I want to toss in a weird movie too that's not Walter Hill related, just if people haven't seen it. It's called Aloha, Bobby and Rose.
Okay.
And it's like a cross between Badlands and American Graffiti. Again, nighttime sort of noir. Oh my God, it's good. It stars Paul LaMatt and Diane Hull.
I love Paul LaMatt and Melvin and Howard. And
I know. He's so good in everything. And so sometimes I'm watching these movies from the 70s. We've talked about stuff like this before where I just can't believe that it exists and I've never heard of it before.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it isn't just a weird movie that exists and I've never heard of it before. It's like a masterpiece that exists and I've never heard of it before. It's at once exciting and humbling and frustrating, you know?
Yeah. For me, that was The Late Show, which I just discovered a few years ago. And I'm like,
R. Carney movie.
And all Liza my Minnelli. Life. Yeah.
Yeah, Ivan Pastor directed that, right? The Czech filmmaker, Ivan Pastor.
It was Lily Tomlin and Art Carney.
Art Carney.
I can't remember the director, but I love it. No, Benton.
It's so good, isn't it?
Was it Benton?
Who is it?
Yeah.
Is it Robert Benton?
I think so.
Oh, man. Yeah, I love Robert Benton. He did I want to sound so stupid. He did Racing with the Moon. Is that right?
I loved Racing with the Moon, so let's
see. Me too.
He did.
Oh, no, he didn't. Did he?
No, I don't see Racing with the Moon here.
Yeah. God. You know, as I get older, I get stupider and stupider.
Oh, no, it's fine. We're jumping all over the place.
I don't know. I don't know why I'm doing that. But he did do Nobody's Fool, right? At Places in the Heart.
Yes, he did. Uh-huh.
Gotcha.
Richard Benjamin. See, you were close.
Richard Benjamin.
RB,
was I?
RB, you know, Robert Benton, Richard Benjamin.
Yeah, they have the same monogram. Yeah. Thanks, Jen. Thanks for figuring that out. I don't know. You know, it's true, though. I've had COVID, I think, 3 times. I'm markedly dumber than I used to be. But also,
you have so much info out there. Yeah.
Sigh. But yeah, Racing with the Moon is a beautiful film, too. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about. But the Late Show, beautiful film.
Aloha, Bobby and Rose is the other one.
Aloha, Bobby and Rose. Yeah. God, it's good. It's just one of those movies. They're just kids hanging out, being stupid in LA at night, sort of cruising, and something terrible happens and they're falling in love and they have to make some decisions. It's just everything I kind of like about a movie. And it's just, there's such a sense of melancholy and nostalgia about it. And also, again, that sense of uncanny where you're like, what's going on? Where is this happening? It's nighttime in LA when it's empty in the 1970s. There's nothing going on there. And it's, it was like in the middle of everything. Just to kind of flip around and discover new masterpieces really makes me feel like, maybe there's hope for us. You know, we keep making beautiful things, and even if they're forgotten for a while or buried, they always seem to come back to the surface. So maybe art wins at the
end. Yeah, it's never too late to find these masterpieces. How did you find that film? And I think I Googled it, and it wasn't readily available.
I think since then Tubi has picked it up. It's directed by Floyd Mutrux. I'm going to screw this up again. Floyd Mutrux, and he did American Hot Wax, which is another movie that I really love and sort of kind of fallen away, you know? And so I was watching American Hot Wax again, and I was like, realized I didn't know who this director was. So I did a little tiny bit of research and went through his filmography, and then finally I found Aloha Bobby and Rose. Someone had uploaded it somewhere, and I was just like, oh my god, you know.
Great.
Yeah, and he also did American Me, the Edward James Olmos film.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, which is probably more familiar, more remembered anyway. Yes. But he didn't direct that. I think Olmos did, but he wrote it, I think. I'm probably screwed that up. It's probably Richard Benjamin again. But but anyway, you know, there was kind of a line that I followed back to him. And I don't know. It's the way that we used to find things, right? Where you would read the album liner notes.
Yes, you go down a little rabbit hole.
Yeah. And I it's that kind of curiosity, I think, that has been the most rewarding, has led to the most rewarding discoveries for me, where I'm like, who is this person? Who's this editor? Who's this director? Who's this writer? Whatever. And you go down this really often very fruitful rabbit hole.
Yes, absolutely. Well, kind of like this conversation, Walter, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's always such a joy. You have to come back and do a whole episode on a topic of your choosing.
I would love to. I'm so honored that you always pick up the phone. And I wish that I was more focused and less discursive. Thanks for being so patient and making it seem like I make sense more than I ramble. I appreciate that.
You make a lot of sense. I always learn stuff. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate it. Be well.
You too. Next up, we have Duncan Birmingham. Duncan is a writer, director, and producer living in Los Angeles. He's the filmmaker behind the movie Who Invited Them? He worked on Marin and Blunt Talk. And he's also the author of the book The Cult in My Garage. Well, Duncan, I am so glad to be reunited with you. You're a wonderful film mind. We've had such great conversations. I really love the one that we did on Hal Ashby. Of course, we had fun going over John Cusack and also Dennis Hopper. So how are you doing?
Don't forget Noah Baumbach.
Noah Baumbach? Yes. Yes.
I like to think I'm a regular on the
yeah.
show.
Yes, you are.
I'm good. No complaints. I don't want to eat up the whole podcast if I launch into my complaints. So yeah, just buckling down and doing crazy 2025, and excited to be here because I love talking LA movies.
Yes, absolutely. No, I wanted to be sure to honor LA. I've been there like 6 times in the last couple of years. It's, you know, becoming like my favorite city. So many good friends there. So many that every time I swing in there, I can barely fit everyone in, and then I want to come back. So I can't wait to come back and see everybody. But yes, and so many wonderful movies. Everybody talks about New York movies, but LA has their own, you know, history of great film, of course, because that is where the movies are made. And so we were throwing around ideas. We had several, I know, like The Player and a few others. But when you brought up Swingers, all of a sudden it clicked because nobody had brought that one up to me so far. And so I was super excited. It's been so long since I saw it. How about you?
It had been quite a while. I was super excited to do it. Yes, I mean, LA is the home of movies. Right now we're trying to keep it the home of movies, because I'm sure you've read about in the papers about how the tax incentives everywhere else are so great that there's the production here has dwindled, but hopefully we're going to be bringing it back, to LA. And I mean, that is what's so one thing so magical about the city. When I moved out here in 2000, is it feels like you've been here before. It's a deja vu dream city where you're, you know, driving to a random apartment building and you're like, hold it, have I seen this in movie? and why are all these street names vaguely familiar? So when I moved out in to LA in 2000, obviously there were a lot of great LA movies in my head, but there were a few that I'd seen in the late 90s when the idea of moving to LA was percolating, that you know, had really lodged in my brain, and my LA experience kind of, you know, felt very enmeshed with those, and movies like The Big Lebowski and Pulp Fiction. Oddly enough, even though it's mostly interiors, the movie adaptation of Hurley Burley, there was a scene where Sean Penn drives down to like a strip mall at the bottom of Mulholland Drive in his convertible, and he's talking on the phone the whole way and he's barefoot. And I'm like, oh, is that how it labeled? You're like in a city, but you're driving to the local strip mall barefoot. Something about that resonated. And of course, Swingers.
Yes. Yeah. And because it had just come out a couple years before that. Where did you move from?
I moved from Boston. I think my parents might have seen Swingers and mentioned it.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it on video. This was during the swing dance craze.
Yes,
I feel like
the
I
Gap
kind of,
ads. Yeah, my God,
yeah. The killed by the Gap ads.
Yeah,
I vaguely remember it. I guess I was there. I wasn't really part of it. I remember really loving Swingers when I saw it, and then when I moved out to LA in 2000, I moved into an apartment building in Los Feliz, the neighborhood on the east side where a lot of the Swingers stuff takes place. And I remember some of the other people in the building were like, oh yeah, the rents used to be a lot cheaper before Swingers came out. So the tail end of Swingers, the swing dance craze had died down, but the aftershocks of the movie and kind of the popularity of the neighborhood was still very much felt by me. So
yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you wanted to be able to run into Mike and everybody at the diner. You wanted to see what Trent was going to do, if he was going to jump on a table. You wanted to play golf with them at the golf course there. Yeah.
I mean, the movie, having watched it a couple nights ago, brought back so many memories. Almost felt like a home videos of a time that I wasn't really here for. The opening credits, I had forgotten about. There are all these you know, analog photos of people in bars and horsing around and on the LA streets, and they look so fun. And then you see all these great exteriors of all these bars and restaurants, places that I really love, a lot of which aren't here anymore. Kind of now I have to say maybe my favorite LA movie opening credits after Barfly, which I love those opening credits where they show all the old bar facades. And I believe Smog Cutter is the only bar that's in both sets of credits. So,
oh, wow.
I was really hooked with this rewatch from the beginning. I was seeing Cantor's, Smog Cutter, the Chateau, Musso's, and just really settling into the vibe of late 90s East Side LA.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I saw this in like suburban Minneapolis, basically on video around the time. I remember a guy in my high school acting class, which I just took as a writer, essentially. It was like the worst actor in the world, but was raving about this and, you know, oh my God, the dialogue. And so I could not wait. Everybody was talking about the screenplay, of course. And I mean, it's the perfect example of generating your own material, but just watching it and being from that era, I mean, we used to have to actually walk up to people and ask them out. There were no apps. There was no meeting on social media or what any way that people meet now. It's all very, you know, we're losing the ability to talk to one another. I also love the whole, you know, we had answering machines, which were fucking nightmares because you never knew when it was going to cut off. And I've had those experiences. I didn't call back like 67 times, but, right. You know, yes. So it's just a great movie from that era. Yeah. Brings back such memories.
Yeah. So great from that era. Cause yeah, right before the dawn of cell phones and so many other things. And yeah, that the guys in the movie go out and the main goal isn't to, really even to hook up. It's to score those digits.
Yes.
Obsessed with getting digits written on a cocktail napkin. And I remember those days, and there's just so many great little pop culture juggernaut moments in this movie, especially to think that it was an indie that was a big hit. But yeah, all the dialogue about the 3-day rule, I think that all originates with Swingers. I'd never heard that before. So besides the swing dancing and the music and the vibe, yeah, there's just a lot in here that really kind of permeated the culture, and rewatching it, I was excited to watch an indie that was had such a sharp script. And you're right. Yeah. It's really a Cinderella story, almost like Rocky-esque, with Favreau writing the script for him to star in. And then he doesn't have the juice to direct it, but it gets Doug Liman, and it's them and all their friends. And you feel that, and it feels real. And it has a great, like, fly on the wall quality that you're hanging out with these bros.
Yeah, absolutely. They're cinephiles. I also love that they're paying homage to the movies that they're talking about and that they love, because we're in their apartments, which would have been their real apartments. And we're seeing, you know, the posters that these people would have on the wall, Reservoir Dogs and Taxi Driver. And, you know, it says so much about the personalities of all of these people. I think everybody gets at least one moment to shine, which is so good when you have such a stellar ensemble cast of their friends. You know, of course, this is Vince Vaughn's movie. I mean, he has so much energy and charisma. He just like comes off the screen. I mean, Spielberg saw this and like immediately gave him The Lost World based on his performance in this movie. But, you know, you have Ron Livingston. The whole debate about Goofy is really great. The actor that plays Sue is phenomenal. I also just like some of the bit players in the film. Yeah, it's a great one.
Yeah, there's I had to look up because I was like, geez, is that something we used to say to each other? It's money. Is that a Vince Vaughn? And you probably saw it too, because it did seem vaguely familiar that it was something Spike Lee says to Michael Jordan in those ads where Spike Lee was playing She's Gotta Have It alter ego. That I guess Vince Vaughn kind of claimed and made his own.
Yeah, Beautiful Babies. And I mean, it's a little dated with the lingo, you know, it's a little stylized, but it's just fun. Yeah.
Super fun. Yeah, so I was caught up in multiple waves of nostalgia. One for that late 90s period, and two as like a Los Angelino. Like there were names of places like the Lava Lounge and the Three of Clubs and the Derby, and that I was like, oh, I forgot all about those places because I caught the tail end of them. But they're pretty prevalent in the movie. Another thing that really struck me that I feel like really speaks to this movie standing the test of time is as kinda goofy, slightly homophobic, and as the dudes are.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, the Jon Favreau Mike character who's heartbroken, when he's upset, his bros like have his back so hardcore. I mean, the Vince Vaughn character, you know, literally tears himself away from making out with the Las Vegas Matrix to peer outside. He's got to check on his boy. And then even after Jon Favreau like blows their chance for this big sexy night, you know, Vince Vaughn's not mad. He's his priority is showing his buddy a good time. And the Ron Livingston character like couldn't be, is practically his therapist. He's so sweet. So that really, I feel like that really helps this movie like stand the test of time. And it feels like such a, it does such a great job of capturing like the tribalism of friends that are far from home, you know, trying to make it out here, you know, New Yorkers trying to make it in LA. And we've seen that in a bunch of movies, but it's so specific, and well done in this that it really, resonates. And even as a not New Yorker, but New Englander, you know, reminded me of myself and my friends.
Yeah, there's something about that age group when you are far from home for the first time. I mean, it happens in college, you know, you're living in quarters and you're depending on each other. But definitely in a dog-eat-dog world like LA, especially if you're trying to be an actor, you are gonna find the people that you rely on, that you count on. And I do love that about this because on the one hand, I mean, you forget like, yeah, there's homophobia and like for a little bit, he's so angry and heartbroken. Every other word out of Favreau's mouth for a little bit is skank. Like, oh, this is a skank shift and that's a skank. And, you know, like every other word. Yeah. But deep down, he just wants a nice girlfriend at the end of the day. And he just wants to be back in a nice relationship and to be secure. And there's this scene where he's been depressed for like a good 6 months, bad breakup, where he isn't leaving the apartment and Ron Livingston comes in and checks on him. And yeah, there is something really sweet about that. Looking out for your friends. You find out like who has your back essentially in times like that. And that's something cool about swingers that I think, you know, in the bravado and you miss exactly what you were saying, Duncan. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that really worked for me in the movie. And yeah, just the moments of seeing like Marty and Elaine at the Dresden Room.
Yeah.
And as I had forgotten that what a big centerpiece the whole swing dance scene was, where you're like, oh, Jon Favreau knows how to swing dance. I think they say he'd taken some lessons.
Yeah.
And I guess the lesson is, yeah, to get over your ex, just meet Heather Graham at a bar and go swing dancing, and you'll be on the up and up.
Especially if she's from a different city and it's going through another breakup. That is something else I love that's very LA. Everyone is from a different place, which I get here in Phoenix. Pretty much everyone is from a different place. Like the further out west you get, go west, young man, everyone is from somewhere else. Yes.
Yeah, everyone's from somewhere else. So like they're kind of a New York and surrounding New York crew.
Yeah.
And I love how they like introduce new members throughout the movie. And I love the detail of, again, another great like late 90s thing of when they're all driving around together.
Oh, that's perfect.
Nobody has MapQuest or knows where they're going. You spend half the night looking for a party and then they all put the club on their steering wheels. And the movie also does a really good job of it's about people like on the fringe of the business, but they don't do a lot of inside baseball Hollywood.
No.
It's you can just kind of under anyone who's kind of like trying to been in their 20s, trying to break into a new business in a new city can relate. So Yeah, it was a great rewatch to the point where I was like, you know what? I think I might have to watch Made, the Favreau New York comedy that I really liked that wasn't his big hit, but I remember it
That
being
was good.
really good. And Peter Falk was in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, any other LA movies that you want to give a shout out to? Anything that
Oh,
maybe
wow.
doesn't get mentioned a lot or that are some of your favorites as an Angeleno?
Oh my goodness. Oh, now
I'm
I'm on
putting
the
you on the
spot.
spot.
I know I have a list somewhere. I mean, we were talking about Barfly. I love got Hurley Burley's more of a play. I mean, I it's not a it's a documentary, and I'm sure you've talked about it with other people, but I love Los Angeles Plays itself. So when someone moves to LA, if that's playing anywhere, I'm like, you know what? If you have 3 hours, go see that movie, and you'll really get like settled into your city. Huge fan of that. But I'm sure once we log off, I'll think of like 10 great ones. I can't remember what the other ones. I think the ones I suggested you as possible talking points were big LA movies. Oh, I know one that it doesn't really maybe get its due as a big great LA movie is Green Book, which we've talked about in the blowback episode, which the cinematography is amazing. There's just a great it's got a lot of great kind of like anonymous locations. It does have the Musso and Franks and then shots of Musso and Franks are really great, but then it has these beautiful house it has the beautiful houses. It has kind of the dink rinky dinky little like first apartment in LA apartment that Greta Gerwig has, and then it has all these little strip mall locations and kind of anonymous driving locations, and it's very disorienting because Greenberg, the Ben Stiller character, is disoriented. This isn't his city, and I'd list that as kind of a really smart, fun, well, maybe not too fun, a little dark for some audiences, but a really interesting LA movie that I have seen quite a few times.
And if you want another podcast, you can listen to us talk about that one. And also Shampoo, of course,
Oh,
with
wonderful.
Ashby. You can listen to us talk about all of those movies. Well, Duncan, I want to thank you so much for doing this. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, no, I my pleasure is mine. Thanks for having me.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.